This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the rich people who rule Chicago are angry at Mayor Rahm Emanuel for failing to keep Black folks pacified. And how can Black people build a people's movement when so many community organizations aren't accountable to Black people?
But first, activists from around the country will gather at Temple University in Philadelphia on January 8th for a conference on the Black radical tradition. Dr. Cornel West, the nation's best-known Black public intellectual, is one of the keynote speakers. We ask Dr. West if we are witnessing the birth of a real mass Black movement after all these years.
Well, I think, you know, we always call for a mass social movement because that's what we have to fall back on, given what we're up against. Neoliberal order moving toward a police state every day, vicious attacks on our children as well as the fellow workers and poor people. But I think what we do see is an awakening. I wouldn't call it a movement. I would say it's significant motion and momentum that can become a movement if we can sustain it. And that's why Brother Carl Dix and I have been continually trying to intensify the resistance, because we have to keep the motion and momentum in place in order to try to be able to create a movement and then try to sustain that movement once it sets in. But I think that you can imagine, you know, there's a lot of contradictions and a lot of tensions at this moment in terms of people on the move. But the important thing is we got significant number of young brothers and sisters who have broken the back of fear. And you have to break the back of fear in order to generate the possibility of a movement.
That's right. You and Carl Dix, I think it was 4 years ago, formed the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Clearly, you thought that mass incarceration was at least one of the great challenges facing Black America. Now lots of folks seem to agree with you.
Well, I mean, it's what you all, Black Agenda Report, call the mass incarceration state. That's basically what we're talking about, which is a kind of proto-police state in formation. But that's very much what we're talking about. And I think Brother Carl and I sitting down, like you said, about four and a half years ago, saying that we start with stop and frisk, then connect it to the criminal justice system and connect it to mass unemployment, mass underemployment, then it connected to, of course, a critique of capitalism and a critique of empire and patriarchy. So that we had envisioned about 5 years ago when we first went to jail there in Harlem against stop and frisk. And we continue on. And I think the beautiful thing is that we see the collective fight back, because the attacks and the vicious assaults are so ugly. And I'm not just talking about Tamir Rice, but we could start there. But it's the collective fight back. See, that's the key right now.
Well, let us talk about Tamir Rice and the other disappointments in terms of prosecutions of police who kill Black folks, including Black children. We didn't see much in the terms of a collective fight back in terms of demonstrations after that grand jury decision in Cleveland.
Well, I think it probably had something to do with the weather. It had something to do with the timing that the ruling class came. The timing of it was, of course, deliberate. It was quite conscious to do it at a time when almost everybody is on the down low with family and loved ones and things. But we will see collective fight back in Cleveland. Ain't no doubt about that. That's coming in a serious way.
Now, you and Carl Dix were making the connection between the behavior of the police and the other challenges that Black America faces. Do you think under that broad umbrella that people are still calling Black Lives Matter movement, that those connections are also being made?
Well, I don't think they're being made as extensively and intensely as they ought, is mainly because, you know, this vicious legacy of white supremacy, it always hits us in such a raw and coarse way. And so you get critiques of racism, critiques of white supremacy that are not always connected to critiques of capitalism, critiques of empire, critiques of patriarchy. But I do think we have significant voices in what is called the Black Lives Matter momentum, a movement that would make them, but they're not always made. We do have significant voices. I wish we had even more voices making those connections.
What would you like to see come out of this conference at Temple University in Philadelphia?
Well, I would like to see more organic intellectual activity, which is to say I'd like to see more of the academicians and the intellectuals become part of the movements on the ground. I think that we need to have much closer connection and relation to the activists who are actually engaged in the resistance. There's still too much of a distance, it seems to me. And it would be beautiful to have waves of Black intellectuals who were there on the streets with the young folk getting arrested with them. I think that would be a very important witness and a very important source of inspiration for young people.
You know, in 2007 and 2008, for the first time in my memory, there were no organized demands made of the Black presidential candidate. Now folks are making demands of a kind. We can see a difference in the last several years.
Well, I think that's true, but I think so much of it has to do with the cowardice of our Black political class. I mean, we just haven't had enough politicians who would make demands on the Black president, demands on the nation state. And that's one of the ways that we can see why the police were militarized, that intense militarization of the police departments under a Black president with the Black Congressional Caucus, many of them being complicitous in that regard. And the same is true about, of course, the very ugly irony of it all, a Black Lives Movement under a Black president, telling the Black president, you act as if Black lives don't matter. We have to remind you Black lives do matter. Well, you see, that says it all right there. That says it all right there. And I think as Black America begins to emerge from the sleepwalking vis-a-vis a Black president and begin to fall more deeply in love with their Black young people who are shot down like dogs, then they'll break that kind of fear of being critical of the Black president out of love for young Black people.
45 years and more ago, when there was undeniably a mass grassroots Black movement afoot, folks were concerned about criticism and self-criticism as watchwords of movement politics. Do you think that folks in the current awakening, as you put it, understand the value of internal criticism and self-criticism?
No, I don't think we've learned the lesson. I think we need more of the spirit of Malcolm X. We need more of the spirit of Fannie Lou Hamer, who always were willing to engage in very intense criticism of other Black leaders when they felt that those leaders were beginning to lean in a direction of either sellout, incorporation, or absorption by the powers that be. I think one of the big differences, though, brother, between 40 years ago, then and now, is that we not only live in the age of the sellout, but the unbelievable commodification of the culture, the unbelievable impact of corporate media that we have now that was not in place then. We didn't have 24/7 TV. We didn't have the Rent a Negro phenomenon on the screen when you can just hire Black folk to say what the corporate media wants them to say and act as if somehow they're speaking on behalf of Black people. You see, we didn't have that in the 60s. Just had those three little TV networks. And when Black people saw some Black leader, it was either, I mean, Malcolm was on TV, of course, up until his death in 65. Martin was on TV. You had some Whitney Young. And, of course, at the center of it was Karl Rowan. And we should never downplay the Karl Rowanization of black journalism, that is what has happened. Karl Rowan was the exemplary sellout who spoke on behalf of the administration of his day, who trashed Malcolm, trashed Martin, trashed SNCC, trashed the radicals, trashed the Black Panther Party. But he was the HNIC of journalism. He was the head Negro in charge. And what we have now is a very glitzy version of Karl Rowan on corporate media, with so many of the black pundits doing exactly the same thing he did, but acting as if they so progressive or they so radical.
And yet some call that progress. In fact, measure progress by the number of glitzy black talking heads out there.
Yeah, and I would say no, not at all. It's regressive at a spiritual level, regressive at a moral level in terms of integrity, because we're seeing more and more the loss of integrity among the glitzy Negroes on TV. And the same would be true with the relative loss of integrity among so-called black leaders. And, of course, the poor black church now has just been so devastated by chicanery and devastated by mediocrity, devastated by mendacity. It's become one of the sites where sellout sensibility is most visible. It's a very sad affair. I say that, of course, as a revolutionary Christian.
That was Dr. Cornel West of Union Theological Seminary in New York.
Everybody knows that Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel is in trouble with black folks who are outraged at the lawlessness and violence of the city's police. But political analyst, author, and activist Paul Street says Mayor Emanuel has also lost the confidence of the rich white people who really call the shots in Chicago.
Yeah, he's doesn't seem to be doing his job. One of the main jobs for Mayor of Chicago, frankly, is to keep the black community in line and non-rebellious, so that downtown financial real estate commercial interests can continue their endless gentrification and expansion, free of disturbance. You know, something the Dailies were very good at, Richard M. Daley, pacification. And there's just something missing with Emanuel on numerous levels. And there's a kind of insensitivity and gruffness that's intersected. There's a kind of deficiency, let's put it that way, in Emanuel's style and attitude that has interacted with a structural crisis and an ongoing problem of institutional racism, particularly around the criminal justice system in Chicago, which is, I always kind of thought was getting away a little bit from the national spotlight, police shootings until recently, and now so with this Laquan McDonald video, which has been badly mishandled on numerous levels by Rahm Emanuel, who had already irritated significantly the black community in Chicago with his schools policies and with other aspects of his agenda here in town. It has really sparked a significant black, largely youth-led rebellion against his rule that ended up hitting the pocketbook of commercial interests, and particularly when it interfered with Christmas holiday sales. And I think brilliantly, the interference with shopping on the Gold Coast up in Michigan Avenue. That's sort of the Fifth Avenue, you know, New York City's Fifth Avenue, Manhattan's Fifth Avenue. And Chicago is Michigan Avenue. And there were some very brilliant actions up there. And also further, just a little bit south down in the Loop, the old traditional shopping district, that ended up messing with proceeds. Retailers, Macy's and Water Tower Place and all these big parts that are part of sort of the classic, I don't want to say just white, but sort of the classic middle, upper class shopping experience in downtown. And they lost revenue because some of the protests that were sparked over Laquan McDonald. And rich folks don't like the people that actually run the city of Chicago, the real rich folks. The 0.1% are not happy with that. And they say some pretty interesting things about Rahm Emanuel these days.
Well, when we talk about the bottom line, especially for the very rich, the people who rule, they're not just talking about retail sales and the holiday season. They're talking about the future prospects for land values and gentrification, the whole economic picture in Chicago. And that doesn't look good if there's a prospect for continued black unrest.
Yeah, they're just constantly stretching the frontiers of gentrification. And you always see this increase of really nasty policing, stop and frisk trafficking. There's all this ginning up of harassment and throwing people in jail and hitting them with little violations, and generally speaking, people of color, Latinos, and predominantly African Americans, on these edges of these ever-expanding real estate frontiers. And there is a growing consciousness in the black population about what this is all about, that this isn't random. This isn't just, you know, this isn't just mean police. This is all part of a machine, for so-called growth machine, for, you know, it's all about realizing value on vested capital in real estate and commercial investments. Yeah, so that's exactly what the primary concern is. They can make up some of the shopping dollars in other kinds of ways when you start calling into question the whole project of gentrification. That's really a systemic kind of thing.
Yeah, it may not be about the individual meanness of police, but there's plenty of meanness coming from the police. You write of 10,000 excessive force complaints filed since 2008, but that's only resulted in 4 officers being dismissed.
Well, it's like I was saying, I was kind of wondering when the shit was going to hit the fan, so to speak, with regard to Chicago, because, I mean, police brutality in that city, it's just absolutely legendary, going way back. And, you know, we've been focused on Ferguson, and we've had a number of instances recently to focus on New York City with Eric Garner and so forth. But there was the killing of Rekia Boyd years ago. I mean, there are any number of very problematic situations with the Chicago police in the black community in Chicago. It was a tape that had to be released in the wake of the rebellion over Laquan McDonald, about a young man named Ronald Johnson, and then that tape had to be released. And they claim he had a gun in his hand, and it isn't clear that he did it all. And this is somewhere over on the west side. And it's extremely clear that the cops are just shooting him in the back as he's running away. So often these incidences have to do with young men often simply running away because the police are involved in the business of trying to round them up. They are prisoner catchers, and they are also looking for opportunities to shake people down for money, to hit them with various violations that help drive city revenue. There's this shakedown all across urban America, and I suppose even small town America and inner ring suburban America, where local jurisdictions are trying to raise revenue that they've lost because neoliberal tax cuts on the rich by shaking particularly minority relations down and locking them up. And there's a bigger sort of structural institutional aspect of trying to drive rural downstate, and, well, that's what we call it in Illinois, downstate. In New York, it's upstate. Prison economies with the chattelized raw material dragged in handcuffs to distant rural locations. And so there's this roundup that's going on all the time, and it goes on all the time in Chicago. It's only when I worked in the South Side in the black community for years, down at 45th and Michigan Avenue, that I used to get every once in a while caught up in dragnets of seatbelt checks. One of the times, the cops figured out I was white and apologized to me for pulling me over, and I'd turn around and look around at the dragnets and see 6-7 other cars of black Chicagoans pulled over. So what? So the cops could tear them apart. The seatbelt, it's just a pretext stop, and it's an attempt to rifle through their cars and try to discover or perhaps to plan some substance. And this is just rife across the city. We have got stop and frisk. There's a gang ordinance in the city, and you'll see if there's, you know, if more than 3 young black men gathering on a street corner, they will get run in. You'll see a cop run it up to them in a neighborhood like North Lawndale on the west side, or a neighborhood like Inglewood on the south side. And so this has been ongoing. There have been many many shootings. There's a history of police torture and forced confessions that were just absolutely notorious out of a station on the far south side of Chicago run by a police captain named John Burge. There is still a black site detention facility where predominantly black and Latino drug offenders, nonviolent typically, are disappeared for days at a time and commonly tortured out in a place called Holman Square on the west side. It's sort of an open secret. So, the history's caught up with Chicago a little bit in the wake of the Laquan McDonald case.
The police are the point of conflict right now, but for much of his mayorship, Rahm Emanuel's nemesis has been the teachers, and they're preparing for a possible strike.
Yeah, and that doesn't please the ruling class any more. That Emanuel looks like he's going to be facing his second major Chicago teachers union strike. Well, he could in the spring. The teachers union, I think, smelled some blood in the water in the wake of all this Laquan stuff. And they have these ongoing issues about school closings and other related matters. And the school closings are very predominantly in the city's incredibly still segregated public schools. And they are all part of Emanuel's long-standing school, neoliberal schools privatization agenda, which is, of course, part of a broader national trend. Obama's a big fan and advocate of that. And they just had a strike authorization vote of 88%. That's pretty high for a strike authorization vote. And they're speaking in no uncertain terms about their willingness to walk the picket lines again. And you'll see a lot of, if that happens, you'll see a lot of picket lines. You'll see a lot of protests downtown with a lot of black students and Latino students and parents and teachers and their white supporters around City Hall. And then you'll see a lot of picket lines around all these schools that are like 90% and more black, with largely black teachers and so forth. And there'll be a color to that and a race to that, and that'll feed the sense that Emanuel is not doing his job of keeping the city's black population properly pacified, which is what white Chicago mayors are supposed to do. And his approval rating right now citywide is at 18%. So he appears to have lost the support of a certain number of the percentage of the white population as well.
You're a veteran observer of social protest as well as an activist yourself. There's been a proliferation of young black-led organizations in Chicago. What's the level of political sophistication here?
Well, I've met a few activists there. One group in particular that I interacted with a little bit and seems really to have their stuff together is called We Charge Genocide. And then they're affiliated and do some common actions with Asada's daughters, Asada being Asada Shakur, which is a largely black feminist organization full of all kinds of creative young people. But if you look at We Charge Genocide's agenda, they have a really deep understanding of what needs to be done in Chicago with regard to the criminal justice system and broader and other and related issues. And I think it's pretty impressive. I think it's really impressive. First of all, the strategic vision to go and target pocketbook interests by boycotting shopping, which I think was absolutely brilliant. But it's about much more than Rahm Emanuel or Anita Alvarez, the state's attorney who participated in the Laquan McDonald cover-up. They have a much broader vision than just seeking personnel changes atop the system. And they talk a lot about, among other things, defunding the police. They have a very sophisticated critique of what the liberal comeback is to all this protest, which is that there ought to be more community policing. That's Obama's phrase. Emanuel talks about community policing. Urban political machines across the country talk about, the solution to all these problems, more community policing. And they talk about how this community policing is really just sort of a cover for gentrification and for an enlistment of local citizens, and often in gentrifying areas, local white property owners and condo owners. sort of a deeper enlistment in this totalitarian surveillance and monitoring of lower class black populations. And they talk about defunding the police and taking money that had been invested in this endless surveillance and harassment and incarceration and sentencing and redistributing those tax dollars to what inner city communities really need, which are social services, which are investment, which are real resources. And they're thinking about institutional change. They're talking about structural change. They're talking about a redistribution of wealth in the cities. That's pretty neat to see. They're not going to be satisfied just because Emmanuel is forced out, if he is, either before his next election or just forced out of, you know, of not running the next time. You know, that's not going to be enough. And they're critical of, you know, they have a kind of class consciousness, which is in a related generational consciousness about myths, leaders within their own black community, and are quite, I think, understandably hostile to the older black bourgeois so-called civil rights generational leadership that frankly has been steering people, the black vote, forever into the white-run downtown growth machine-based, you know, urban machines. Richard M. Daley, go all the way back to Richard J. Daley, and now Rahm Emanuel. So they're pretty militant in their tactics and radical in their vision, and that's pretty nice to see.
Paul Street's latest book is titled They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy.
Last year, President Obama succeeded in putting his Trans-Pacific Partnership corporate trade treaty on a fast track toward ratification by Congress. But opponents of TPP think they have a good chance of defeating the treaty in the new year. Kevin Zeese is with Popular Resistance.
The big next steps are the State of the Union. President Obama on January 12th is going to make a very big push for the TPP as his top priority in Congress for 2016. It's run into some headwinds there. Generally, there are a big contingent of members of Congress who are indebted or bribed, I guess is a more accurate word to say it, by the transnational corporations. But there's also a growing block who recognize these trade agreements are not good for the U.S. economy, not good for the people, and not good for the environment, and also not good for their political careers. And so this election year battle is going to be a very hot one. So January 12th, we make a big pitch, and we're going to have our people out in force online in the Twitter sphere and social media, getting out the facts, because we expect a lot of dishonesty from President Obama to State of the Union.
The two top Democratic presidential candidates are both against TPP. How's that figure in the equation?
That's very important. Also, Donald Trump and Rubio and the Texas Senator Cruz all come out against the TPP. So you have really five of the top candidates saying they're opposed to it. Hillary, of course, you know, has a long history. And even though she says she's opposed to it, she has been a free trader for her whole career, both almost always voting for these trade agreements. And so we expect if she gets elected, she'll be someone we have to push, and she'll be someone we'll have to fight with, because we don't have a lot of confidence in her statements being what she really believes. Sanders is solidly opposed to the TPP, and I would love to see Sanders actually recognize the opportunity that the TPP presents his campaign if he makes a really full-court press with his support base to stop the TPP. I think he could have a gigantic impact. Trump as well. Trump could come into this and say, I'm going to draw a line against the President Obama. I'm going to show I'm stronger than President Obama, even without being elected. And I could see Trump, you know, making a gigantic difference in the conservative base in Congress, which has a lot of questions about the TPP. And we have a lot of people on our side who oppose it from a conservative perspective. So I think those presidential candidates could make a big difference. Same with Rubio and Cruz. They could all make a big difference. They really decide, do they want to stop this and show how weak President Obama is and how strong they are? They could really help a great deal. President Obama is going to sign the TPP on February 4th. It looks like it'll be in New Zealand with all the other presidents and prime ministers signing it. That's the next step in the process. And then that kicks off the final step, which is the fight in Congress. Now, President Obama controls when this goes to Congress, so he can set the calendar. He has to provide the Congress with implementing legislation. Once he does that, then Congress has 90 days, 60 days in the House, 30 days after that in the Senate. Up to that amount, they could do it quicker to vote. And obviously, President Obama will not send it to Congress if he thinks he's going to lose. And so he's going to be feeling the wind in Congress to decide when he provides that implementing legislation. And there are some concerns in Congress. Mitch McConnell, the majority leader of the Senate, Republican from Kentucky, has said that he doesn't think this should be considered until 2017. He thinks the deal is not good enough. It's too hard on tobacco. Doesn't give Big Pharma the amount of monopoly time, the patent time it needs for biologic drugs. And he'd like to see some parts of this renegotiated. So he thinks that a next president, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, will do a better job of negotiating the deal. Now, we can't tell with McConnell whether he's just positioning for negotiation purposes to try to get some, you know, side agreements on those issues, or whether he's serious. And we've seen the same kind of thing from other key senators like Orrin Hatch, who's the most powerful senator on this issue because he chairs the key committee, the Finance Committee. That was interesting. On the House side, we have a new Speaker of the House in Paul Ryan. He served as the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, which is where these trade agreements come from in the House. He was a big supporter of Fast Track. But it was Fast Track that took down John Boehner. It was Boehner's arm twisting and revenge against those who opposed Fast Track that created the revolt that led to him being forced to resign. And so the Tea Party caucus that fought him and forced him out of office is one that Paul Ryan has to be very cautious about. So Ryan has been saying they're reviewing the TPP. They haven't decided yet whether it's good for the United States. If it is, they want to push it through. But he's also been saying things like he's going to be talking with his Republican colleagues to decide what the agenda is for 2016. And so we're not sure where the House is going. And I think if Obama, you know, makes this big push in the State of the Union, that could really be a judo opportunity for us. I mean, the fact that Obama makes this a priority, it may increase the likelihood that the Republicans will oppose it. And with McConnell already saying April 2017, we may see a real revolt in Congress. So that's going to be very interesting to watch. Of course, the movement is not counting on all of that. We are counting on ourselves to do what needs to be done. And so we have a media mobilizer group at flushthetpp.org who are preparing to respond even before he said anything at the State of the Union to get the facts out so the reporters know the truth when they hear the lies. And then also after Obama speaks and during his speech to be responding immediately in the social media. We have people planning events the day of February 4th when the signing happens, and also in the middle of February when they go home for President's Day week. And so protests are being planned. And so the movement is continuing to escalate with these new dates coming up. And if you want to get involved in that, they go to flushthetpp.org and go to the action page. They can sign up, see what actions are happening. I think there's already about 10 states or so that have actions for February. And they'll keep growing. And so we expect we'll see that actions across the country will show that continues to be grassroots opposition. And as I said, if Sanders decides he's going to make this his top priority to stop TPP and show he can lead, I think his base, Sanders' base, could make a tremendous difference in stopping the TPP. So it's a very interesting time, a lot of currents happening. We're feeling like we are organizing strongly and that there's a growing opposition as people become aware of what's in the TPP now that's been made public. So we're hopeful that this can be stopped.
Yes, in terms of judo, January 12th could be a real opportunity to talk about the content of the treaty. Because in the last several months, the headlines have been consumed with the electoral campaign or with ISIS and terror and war and not TPP.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, one of the big successes we had in this fight against Fast Track was in order for that to get passed, the U.S. trade rep and Obama had to give up something they didn't want to give up. And that was they had to make the TPP public. They had to make the TPP public for 90 days after Obama said he intended to sign it. We're in that process right now. And during that 90-day period, there's been a lot of analysis by experts on labor, on the environment, on consumer rights, on water, on food, on energy, all putting out their analysis of the TPP. And no one's out there praising her, I can tell you that. Every expert that looks at this from their area of expertise comes out saying TPP will make things worse. And so we've really built up a lot of information. the January 12th opportunity of the State of the Union and the February 4th opportunity of the signing are opportunities for us to really get those messages out about how bad the TPP is for everything we care about.
And Obama is more a lame duck every day with his powers waning.
Yeah, in fact, the Democrats who are TPP supporters, that group of Democrats, say that if this isn't done in the first few months of the year, it's not going to be done in 2017. So they're pushing hard for rapidly dealing with this in February, March, and April, because after that, it's just too risky. That's why right now is so important, because if there's not the votes after February 4th when it's signed, Obama will withhold it, won't bring it to Congress, and the longer he withholds it, the more dangerous it gets. Of course, we have the risk of the lame duck session after the election, but there's lots of reasons why that won't work, and then we're into 2017 and a new president. And so anything can happen then. You could push to reopen negotiations. The negotiations were very fragile. They could barely get it agreed to by the various countries. So there's lots of opportunities to throw this off and defeat it. If we defeat this and the other two big trade agreements Obama's been pushing with Europe and on trade and services, we can stop all three of these trade agreements, which would be a tremendous people power victory over transnational corporations. They want this really badly. They're going to be spending millions of dollars to get this through Congress in both donations, campaigns, as well as in spending on lobbyists.
That was Kevin Zeis of Popular Resistance speaking from Baltimore.
Talks are scheduled to begin on January 25th between the U.S. and its allies and their jihadist proxies seeking to oust the government of Syria and the Syrian government and its Russian allies. The Americans, the Saudis, and the Turks like to describe their Islamist proxies as moderate rebels, but Syria and the Russians say the Western-backed fighters are terrorists, just like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We spoke with Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition.
Well, it's a complete and outrageous fraud from every direction, and it just shows how determined the U.S., the NATO, European countries are to continue this fraud. They asked Saudi Arabia to head up the countries who will be vetting the, quote, terrorist groups. Now, who's most responsible directly for the arming and the funding from ISIS on through of groups operating in Syria and Iraq and throughout the entire region? So it shows it's not even a serious effort to push back, but it is an effort to protect just a real part of the tremendous number of mercenaries and fanatics that have been sent into the region in an effort to destroy, utterly destroy Syria. It has not succeeded, but it is important to know that there are combatants from 80 countries organized into 1,000 armed opposition groups, and they comprise more than 100,000 reactionary and fanatical fighters. That's how many are operating in Syria now. So when they talk about vetting groups whose names and allegiances change regularly, of course, that's not what this is about at all. It's about protecting the forces that have been created in the region in an effort to destroy Syria.
Yes, it's amazing the contortions that not just the U.S. and its allies, but also the corporate media, the contortions they go through to protect al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, from being labeled the same as ISIS.
It's amazing that just months ago, the U.S. always claimed that al-Nusra was a terrorist force, and this is, it's been its whole heritage. And now suddenly they're one of the forces who supposedly will have a seat at the table. And it was also so completely clear when Russia came in, a real game changer, when at Syria's invitation, the only country, Russia and Iran and the Hezbollah forces from Lebanon who came in at Syria's invitation, there's 13 other countries bombing Syria, not at Syria's invitation, all claiming to be fighting terrorism in Syria and fighting ISIL, never put even a scratch in those lines of more than 1,000 oil tanker trucks at a time crossing the border into Turkey. never touch them or did any significant damage until absolutely pressed to, and then there were a few bombing runs. But they've been bombing Syria for a year without any results. And, of course, then when Russia came into it, there was rage, gnashing of teeth, and actually shooting down of a Russian jet by Turkey, an unprecedented and very dangerous escalation.
One of the results of Russia's intervention seems to be that the United States does not go around saying Assad must go all the time.
They've slightly pulled back on that, it's true, and that's because it's completely untenable. Whether that shows a real change in their thinking, we'll see. It could be that there'll be a pushback on the ISIL forces, but it's always important to know who helped to create and fund and provide the fertile ground for forces like this to grow. It's U.S. wars in the region. It's the absolute destruction of Iraq, of Libya, and now of Syria that have created total turmoil, chaos, and social destruction. The policy to consciously cultivate very vicious sectarian wars, which was used continually in Iraq during the U.S. occupation and is now used in Syria. These are the policies that have given rise to ISIL or ISIS or Daesh, regardless of what name it's called, but this one force that now they're claiming they want to push back. Now they're claiming is suddenly a danger, but they were only too glad to use it, and forces like al-Nusra, who is really very much connected to al-Qaeda.
Seymour Hersh's recent article seems to be saying that even elements of the U.S. military are now abandoning that proxy jihadist strategy, that long-standing strategy of the United States, backing off from it and forcing the administration's hand, Seymour Hersh says, in that area.
He did say that, and maybe he has evidence of individual U.S. generals, he certainly seemed to, and he has access to all different forces within the U.S. intelligence and military apparatus. But while saying that, it's important to know that those who are in the driver's seat right now in terms of policy in Syria, and there are always divisions within the U.S. ruling circles over how best, they always have a track two and a track three and a track four, and their forces in the State Department whose role is to keep talking no matter what, to find venues, to find other ways to try to sabotage a country. So there's always several policies going at any one time. To say that that reflects that there'll be a change in policy, I don't yet see that, but it would be an important development if it actually came about. I think at this point, the U.S. is still committed to doing everything they can to totally destroy, destabilize Syria. And it is important to recognize that in this most, most difficult year, Syria has survived.
Yes, it seems undeniable that the Syrian government is making really dramatic gains on the ground.
It looks that way, and if it can be sustained, that would be tremendous, because the greatest danger is not to hold big vacant spaces, but the population centers, and this is true of so many countries, you know, where a large part of the population exists in several large urban industrialized centers. And those centers, that's where the destruction has been the greatest. When you look at Aleppo, which has been, and now that's one of the oldest continuously inhabited places on the earth, and also the industrial center life of Syria, and it's been all but totally dismantled. And yet, the Syrian government has held on, and the army has held on, has not come apart, as the U.S. predicted it would, announced that it would, that the military would disintegrate, that they would all pick up and run. And that has not happened at a great cost to the population and the military that's fighting. But looking at the alternative, they are literally fighting for the survival of their country, as an independent and sovereign state.
And the Russians have not flinched yet either.
And that is really the big and important development in this, because there is a recognition, I think, on the part now of forces in Russia. This is not only Putin. One person, one man doesn't have a policy. It has to be reflected in the establishment and forces within Russia today. They recognize that if Syria were to fall, that this would only whet the appetite and embolden the U.S. to go further, that they're certainly next on the list. So this is really a question for them and for everyone. This is also true for Iran. They know that more is at stake in Syria than Syria alone, and that the efforts to destabilize countries using this really an invasion of outside forces have to be resisted and stopped.
And China seems to be maintaining its steadfast partnership with Russia in the Middle East.
For the very same reasons that China recognizes that its own sovereignty, its ability to continue to develop, faces one threat. That's coming from the U.S., the policy of encirclement. It's clear to the world what happens when the U.S. imposes sanctions, not only with a blockade of Cuba that's stretched for decades, the sanctions on Iran, but the recent sanctions on Russia. That becomes a lesson to the world. And yet, the U.S. is no longer the economic player, all-powerful, that it was even 10 and 20 years ago. These countries are able to form their own new economic and trade alliances, and that has been very much happening with both Russia and China throughout Asia and expanding trade in Africa. The economy right here, the global economy, is in an extremely dangerous, precarious. There's another earthquake. The capitalist markets, and we should look at 2016 to know that U.S. basic commodity prices have absolutely collapsed. There's a huge glut of oil. It's a third the price it was a year ago, but also of iron, of coal, of copper, zinc, heavy equipment, metal parts, major crops, corn, soy, wheat, are all selling at half and less of last year's price. So there's big layoffs that have been announced in key industries, Alcoa, Caterpillar, John Deere, DuPont, Hewlett Packard, and others. And it's important because the workers in the U.S. have not recovered from the 2007 capitalist crisis crash. The markets, the banks recovered, but the employment figures for the U.S., the unemployment figures are a complete myth. The number of people actually participating in the workforce today is at the lowest level in 30 years, despite population growth. And just to quote a recent study, that in the past 12 years, wages fell for 70% of workers. So we should know that in 2016, there certainly needs to be increased struggle and resistance, because conditions, economic conditions, political and military conditions will worsen. And this is really why they want to promote and give endless publicity to someone like a Donald Trump. How do they prop up this decaying system? This is their challenge, and it's also our challenge of resistance.
And it remains to be seen whether U.S. capital can go without those massive infusions of trillions of dollars of free money that they've been getting from the Federal Reserve, which are not supposed to be in the cards with the raising of interest rates, et cetera.
That's exactly true. How on earth are they going to do that? Because it has been that vast infusion. I think it's past $18 trillion. Since the collapse. And that is what has kept the U.S. economy afloat. They're saying they're going to stop it, and in the face of a new crisis, could even that bail them out? So these are dangerous times ahead.
Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition in New York.
Black America may or may not be in the process of creating a new political movement. However, building a movement based on people's power is difficult when the political geography of Black America is so heavily influenced by nonprofit organizations that are not accountable to the people. Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
The worldview, the class outlook, and the methods of nonprofit organizations have dominated the landscape of the U.S. left for so long, most of us are hardly aware of them. Movement elder Warren Marr shed some useful light on these matters in his indispensable article, Why Nonprofits Can't Lead the 99%, in which he sketches some of the effects and outcomes of the nonprofit ground rules and mindset upon unions and community-based organizations. Wherever the habits and the worldview of the nonprofit world came from, it wasn't from the people's movement. Things were hard everywhere 80 years ago during the Great Depression. People were starving. Unions were frequently illegal. There was no minimum wage, no Social Security, no anti-discrimination laws, and no unemployment insurance. Jim Crow was the letter of the law. Still, people managed to organize, to fight the power, and to win some important victories, pretty much without the kinds of single-issue organizations now regarded in most places as essential. So where did that model come from? The single-issue organization seems to be a creature of the 1960s and 70s, a kind of blocking response to a broad-based movement on the part of elite funders. They know nobody's going to go to an anti-pollution meeting on Monday, a housing meeting on Tuesday, a school meeting on Wednesday, a police and prison meeting on Thursday, and so on. And if all of them are in competition for the same funding dollars, well, so much the better. Similarly, the nonprofit models of movement or advocacy organizations led by self-selected, usually college-educated executive directors, senior staff, and self-perpetuating boards of directors with heavy representation from philanthropic funders are creations of those funders, not of members, and definitely not of any broad-based mass political movement. If membership is defined in these sorts of organizations at all, it might consist of people who pay dues, or people who show up at meetings, or just people on a mailing list. Rarely do members get access to anything like transparency on how funds are handled, or have the power to replace their shot-calling directors and board members. The truth is, the nonprofit model is fundamentally anti-democratic. It's top-down, and it's ideally suited to what Adolf Reed calls the broker type of leader, the unaccountable spokesperson purporting to be the mouthpiece of some united mass constituency which has no power over its alleged leader. Energetic and charismatic leaders of nonprofit organizations can often sustain impressive mobilizations, at least over a short time, but they inevitably fall short on educating their members out of dependence on those self-selected or funder-selected leaders, if they define members at all, and on expanding the base of their leadership. Nonprofit organizations can frequently make impressive use of Facebook and social media, too, but these are mobilizing tools, allowing you to communicate with other activists, the already converted, not organizing tools one can use to identify potential leaders and win over audiences who don't already agree. Dependence upon the nonprofit model is all that Democratic Party honchos desire from the left. They just need an Election Day mobilization. But if the vision of our movement extends to taking power, we have to train a broad base of people to wield power first over their own organizations, then to contend for power over their lives, their economies, and their communities with those who have that power now. It's time to drop the habits of the nonprofit world, time to raise up organizations accountable to well-defined and powerful memberships. It's time to focus on expanding our base, not talking to other activists on Facebook, not keeping the same few leaders out in front of the same few hundred demonstrators. That's the difference between mobilizing and organizing.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.